Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. The hearings continue. The committee investigating the Capitol insurrection focuses on connections between the violence perpetrated by the mob and former President Trump.
The president, got everybody riled up, told everybody to head on down. So we basically were just following what he said.
Then the massacre's aftermath. New video shows inaction by dozens of police officers in Uvalde, Texas, despite the shooting rampage that had just taken place. And a window into the cosmos. NASA releases stunning new photos from the Webb Space Telescope, including never-before-seen nebulas and galaxies. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. The January 6th committee hearing this afternoon, the seventh public meeting, ended with a dramatic revelation. Vice Chair Liz Cheney said former President Trump recently called a witness the committee was talking to, an action the committee referred to the Department of Justice as potential witness tampering. Over the course of 3 hours, the committee also laid out in detail a series of events leading up to the insurrection on January 6th. That began weeks earlier in a mid-December White House meeting that one former aide called unhinged as allies of then-President Trump repeated baseless claims about election fraud and urged action to overturn the results. Later that night, Mr. Trump sent a tweet that one committee member called a call to arms for his supporters. Big protest in D.C. on January 6th. Be there. We'll be wild, he wrote. As the committee showed, supporters of the former president, including members of a far-right militia group, heeded his call. One person even predicted a red wedding. That's a pop culture reference to a massacre on January 6th. Jason Van Tatenhove, a former spokesman for the Oath Keepers, drew the connection and concern for the future.
If a president that's willing to try to instill and encourage to whip up a civil war amongst his followers using lies and deceit and snake oil, and regardless of the human impact, what else is he going to do if he gets elected again? All bets are off at that point.
Representative Stephanie Murphy of Florida read from a text exchange between two Trump campaign advisors, including one-time campaign manager Brad Parscale, who, after the events of January 6th, blamed his former boss.
Mr. Parscale said, quote, "This is about Trump pushing for uncertainty in our country, a sitting president asking for civil war." And then when he said, "This week I feel guilty for helping him win," Katrina Pearson responded, "You did what you felt right at the time, and therefore it was right." Mr. Parscale added, "Yeah, but a woman is dead. And yeah, if I was Trump and I knew my rhetoric killed someone." When Ms. Pearson replied, "It wasn't the rhetoric," Mr. Parscale said, "Katrina, yes, it was."
And for more on what we learned from the hearing, I'm joined by our congressional correspondent, Lisa Desjardins, and White House correspondent, Laura Barone Lopez. Good evening to both of you. Lisa, you were in the hearing room. Let's start by talking about that dramatic confrontation inside the White House. It was December 2020. It was all about whether and how to overturn the election. Tell us more.
We are now at the point, Judy, where the committee is going chronologically right up to January 6th. And this important moment happened in the middle of December after the attorney general had already said there was no reason to believe there was fraud worth overturning the election, already had dismissed what the president, then Trump, had been saying. So let's take you inside who was in this meeting. Four people in particular in this meeting were surprise guests to many of the staffers in the White House. Rudy Giuliani, the president's personal attorney at different times. And there you also see three other people, including Michael Flynn, former security advisor, but then he did not have a position at the White House. There you also see All of the people there who were advising him, Sidney Powell included them, and then Patrick Byrne on the end, who is the CEO of Overstock.com, those four people, the testimony today was that it wasn't clear they actually had been invited to the White House. They somehow at the last minute were able to get into the Oval Office. They all presented, the testimony today said, conspiracy theories that ran the gamut, pushing the president even to do things like declare martial law, to seize election machines, those kinds of things. Also coming into the Oval Office during this meeting then were actual White House staffers. There you see some of them who were involved. Eric Hirschman, the attorney, the staff secretary, Lyons. You see Mark Meadows, chief of staff in and out, and the president's White House counsel, Pat Cipollone. They were pushing back at the four others in what was described in an extensive montage of bites as a very hostile confrontation. Let's listen to how they played it out in the hearing today.
I opened the door and I walked in. I saw General Flynn. I saw Sidney Powell sitting there. I was not happy to see the people in the Oval Office.
Was the meeting tense?
Oh, yeah. It was not a casual meeting.
Explain.
I mean, at times there were people shouting at each other, hurling insults at each other. It wasn't just sort of people sitting around on a couch, like, chit-chatting.
Cipollone and Hirschman and whoever the other guy was showed nothing but contempt and disdain of the president.
I think that it got to the point where the screaming was completely, completely out there. I mean, you get people walk in, it was late at night, it had been a long day, and what they were proposing, I thought was nuts.
I'm gonna categorically describe it as, you guys are not tough enough. Or maybe I put it another way, you're a bunch of excuse the expression, but I'm almost certain the word was used.
That was essentially a battle for the soul of the White House. As that hours-long meeting ran on and on, after it ended, Judy, around 1:42 in the morning, came the tweet that you talked about earlier tonight, that idea of the president asking for people to come to January 6th for a wild protest. That tweet was sent out right after that contentious meeting.
And Lisa, the committee is charging that the president did more than just send out that tweet about a wild protest. What more are they saying?
That's right. As you get closer to January 6th, here's some more of what the committee said. Steve Bannon, the president's advisor, longtime advisor, was on the phone with the president. They said White House call logs showed the morning of January 5th. Now, also on January 5th, I want to remind viewers what Steve Bannon said on his broadcast show. Listen to this quote.
All hell is going to break loose tomorrow. It's all converging, and now we're on, as they say, the point of attack, right? The point of attack tomorrow. I'll tell you this. It's not going to happen like you think it's going to happen. Okay, it's going to be quite extraordinarily different. And all I can say is strap in.
So Steve Bannon had spoken with President Trump before he made that statement. He spoke with President Trump again that evening. Also the evening of January 5th, the committee wanted to point out there was a rally down the street from the White House, one that some of the advisors of President Trump was full of the crazies, people that had extreme views. There you see video that we saw in the hearing today. Also testimony we heard was that President Trump opened the doors of the Oval Office to try and hear that rally from where he sat. So again, leading up to January 6th, the very day before, you have his advisors talking to him and talking about sort of an extreme day ahead on the 6th.
And Lisa, we know there were two witnesses today, one of them a member of the, or former member, I should say, of this extremist white nationalist group, the Oath Keepers, the other one, someone who took part in the Capitol attack.
That's right. You played that concern earlier from the former member of the Oath Keepers, who was not present at the Capitol on January 6th. He wasn't with the group then. But he said this was, in fact, not just a militia group, but a violent militia group. Then we heard from another man, Stephen Ayers. He's from Ohio. He said he was watching social media leading up to January 6th, and he believed that the election was stolen. He says he no longer sees it that way. But the committee asked him exactly why he did what he did on January 6th, and here's what he said.
So why'd you decide to march to the Capitol?
The president, got everybody riled up, told everybody to head on down. So we basically were just following what he said.
Did you think that the president would be marching with you?
Yeah, I think everybody thought he was going to be coming down. He said in his speech, it's kind of like he's going to be there with us. So, I believed it.
And Mr. Ayers is yet to be sentenced. He'll be sentenced in September. To that question of whether the president wanted a riotous crowd to come to the Capitol, the committee today is trying to make the case, it seems, that this was not unintentional passions that he inflamed, but something very intentional. I want to also call up, if we can, a draft tweet that the committee says it uncovered from that group of advisors who wanted things like martial law. And they said this tweet shows that the president signed off. This was never sent out, but something that the President Trump himself saw, claiming before the January 6th rally, asking people to march to the Capitol. So the case they're trying to make in the committee here is that, in fact, this was an intentional march on the Capitol that President Trump wanted to lead. Another note, Judy, this was actually an emotional day, I think, for some of the Capitol police officers who were in there today. They did shake hands, one of the officers shake hands with Mr. Ayers, with the Oath Keeper. And talking to them afterward, they said that their lives are forever changed by January 6th. Those men have lives that have been changed as well. One of the officers, Harry Dunn, told me, and I saw the look in his eye, Judy, when he looked across at the man who had broken into the Capitol and attacked him and other officers who had broken into the Capitol. Harry Dunn said, I'm not sure what I felt, but it might have been anger. I'm still processing. So it was an emotional day, certainly at the end of that hearing.
It certainly had to be for them. And quickly, I want to bring in our White House correspondent, Laura Barone Lopez. So, Laura, how does what we learned today fit into this larger picture that the committee's pulling together of what President Trump did and any potential criminal charges against him?
Those two things that Lisa just mentioned, the draft tweet that the president saw, as well as testimony from Stephen Ayers saying that he was just following former President Trump's lead and then that was the reason he was there, that could potentially inform, if the Justice Department decides to charge the former president, it could inform an obstruction of congressional proceedings charge. Now, that's because that would potentially prove that the president was trying to stop the lawful certification of the 2020 vote. Another one that was revealed today was that Congresswoman Liz Cheney said that since the last hearing, the president tried to call a witness, which we have not heard from yet, and that they have referred that to the Justice Department as potential witness tampering. She said that the committee takes that very seriously. So that could potentially be another charge. But again, we don't know if the Justice Department is going to pursue this. Now, one important piece of context here, as the hearings are happening, as these talk of potential charges against the former president, is that President Trump, just as recently as June, said that he would, if elected again, pardon these January 6 rioters, people involved in the insurrection, because he believes that they are patriots. And Congressman Jamie Raskin said to the public that that potential for Republicans and that the Republican Party, along with Trump, to continue down the road of authoritarianism could be a big problem. One final thing is that NewsHour can report that a week from Thursday, we expect what is going to be the final hearing in this series. There is the potential for more hearings, and it's going to be focused specifically on the 187 minutes of when President Trump was not putting out any statements as the insurrection was ongoing.
So these hearings are continuing. Laura Barone Lopez, Lisa Desjardins, we thank you both. And for more analysis of today's hearing, I am here with Mary McCord, director of the Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection, and a former Justice Department official, and Jamil Jaffer. He's a law professor at George Mason University and former associate counsel to President George W. Bush. Hello to both of you. Thank you for being with us tonight and during our special coverage today. Jamil Jaffer, I want to come to you first because, again, so much of this evidence, as we've just been hearing from our own correspondents today, was around former President Trump, his role, what he heard, what he did, and what he didn't do. He remains at the center of everything we are hearing.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Judy. What's clear is the president understood what was likely to happen. He was clearly talking to folks outside the White House in the lead up to the events that happened on January 6th, including ostensibly either he or people around him were telling the organizers that there would be a call that they weren't supposed to talk about, but there was going to be a call to march on the Capitol. That was something that they tweeted about internally. We now know was disclosed to them early on. And so the president, what appeared to have originally been a sort of moment that would have happened, you know, spontaneously, turns out to have been a planned moment. The president, or at least the people around the president, knew that was going to happen. And there were other really interesting revealing points to today's testimony.
Yeah, there was so much to look at. And Mary McCord, I mean, as you look at this, you see, again, just a cascading set of pieces of evidence, of information that add up to a president who was looking for affirmation for what he believed and what he wanted to do.
That's right. And I think one of the other really revealing things was, and you know, the excerpts you played earlier at the top of the hour focused on this December 18th really heated meeting where his own White House advisors basically said, we're not going to support you doing any of these things that Sidney Powell and Michael Flynn and Rudy Giuliani were suggesting that he should do. They just went to the mat and it resulted in yelling and shouting and they refused. And it seems like then he reached a decision point, which was, okay, I'm not going to get any help from my White House advisors. I'm going to go to the people. And he tweeted, you know, that early morning, be there, be wild. And that was the calling card for extremist groups such as the Oath Keepers, the Proud Boys, the Three Percenters, and individuals like Stephen Ayers and so many people who'd been just, you know, and Stephen Ayers said this, who had been addicted to his social media, reading everything that President Trump had ever said about a fraudulent election and what others were saying, all of which were lies and which he now knows were lies.
And as we were watching this unfold in real time, Jamil Jaffer, we had no idea what was going on, or very little idea what was going on inside the White House. I know there was certainly reporting at the same time, but we're now learning that there were a number of people around the president who were saying to him and talking to each other about what was happening was wrong. It was illegal.
Right. No, that's exactly right. I mean, Pat Cipollone, now it's clear, made clear to the president that he didn't think he was getting good advice, that these folks around the president, Sidney Powell, Rudy Giuliani, this Overstock.com CEO, who simply didn't even know and asked him who he was in this meeting in the White House, the Oval Office. I mean, you know, by the way, it's worth noting that when I was in the Bush administration, there was no chance that you would have had three random people in the Oval with the president, you know, with no supervision, no White House staff. I mean, it's completely crazy. And the idea that the president was getting legal advice from these folks, you know, is catastrophic, as Pat Cipollone rightly pointed out. And, you know, look, he made clear to the president he did not agree with this advice, that was bad advice. And then you go further, you look at what he told Mark Meadows and said, look, people are going to get hurt, and I'm not going to allow this to go forward. If you recall Cassie Hutchinson's testimony. And so it's clear that, you know, that the president was aware that there were concerns in the White House. John Ratliff, his DNI, said the same thing. And so, you know, nobody can doubt today. No Republican, no Democrat doubt today. The president knew what the potential was to happen, and he acted and went forward nonetheless, knowing all that. And that's the really troubling thing about what we've learned over the last few weeks about Donald Trump and the January 6th events.
And an additional point, I think, that emerged today, Mayor McCord, and this is something you follow, is the role that these extremist groups play, the Oath Keepers, the Proud Boys. You were saying to us earlier that when you look at the bigger picture of what happened, the president, former president, was using them to achieve an end.
He was. And, you know, they were very willingly being used to the Oath Keepers. Now, some of the people, I think, you know, unaffiliated with extremist organizations really did get used and lied to and then left hung out to dry. I mean, they're facing the consequences, criminal charges, loss of their jobs, loss of their reputations. But groups like the Oath Keepers, this is the kind of thing that Stuart Rhodes and other leaders of extremist organizations have wanted for years. You know, they're anti-government organizations. They're willing to use violence against the U.S. government. They've done it in the past. As Jason Van Tatenhove explained today, a former propagandist for the Oath Keepers, you know, they you know, faced off against federal agents back in Bunkerville, Nevada in 2014, and federal agents backed away, you know, because they had firearms, you know, they were in the sights of snipers on overpasses. But here was a chance to actually bring these groups together, and coalesce with people in President Trump's orbit mm-hmm. who wanted to use that, who were willing, and Trump himself willing, to use these types of means to maintain his illegitimate power. And I think, you know, those of us who study some of these organizations have been really trying to point out for years their potential, you know, their dangerousness. And it was really there in living color, and hearing, you know, from a former spokesperson, I think gives us an insight that we don't normally get. And I hope people will really understand that these are threats and they need to be addressed.
And it certainly need to be taken very, very seriously. Jamil Jafford, just quickly, another data point today, which adds to the evidence we've already seen that former President Trump, in that tweet that he drafted about after the rally, you'll be going to the Capitol. It wasn't sent, but it does signal what was in the former president's mind at that time.
No, that's exactly right, Judy. It was clear. Now we know the president was thinking about sending a tweet like that. We know that the people around him told the rally organizers, the president is going to send people to the Capitol. Don't tell anyone, keep it on the down low, but that's what's going to happen. So that whole thing that looks spontaneous clearly was planned ahead of time. And then you add on what the president said to Cassie Hutchinson. I know they have weapons. I don't care. Send them through the mags. They're not here to attack me. They're going to the Capitol. We now know what the president knew before he called on those people to go to the Capitol. And we know the aftermath of what happened, Judy.
And just quickly, Mary McCord, I mean, it adds up to what you've just been saying, that when you think about the potential lethality of these groups and the former president knowing that, and then he still was engaging them and urging them to move ahead.
That's right. And it goes back to, you know, the famous stand back and stand by, the comment he made during a presidential debate directed to the Proud Boys, who immediately recruited based on that and merchandised and made money based on that. And so, you know, I think we really have to look to the future, too, and we have to look abroad. You know, in other countries, it was the willingness of politicians to ally with dangerous private militias that has caused, you know, real collapses in democracies or the inability to develop into democracies and authoritarianism. And so, you know, the prospect in the future, Representative Raskin mentioned, and Jason, it's real.
Sobering lessons from all of this. Mary McCord, Jamil Jafford, thank you both.
Thank you.
In the day's other news, Ukraine's military said it destroyed a Russian ammunition depot in the east, possibly with a rocket system supplied by the U.S. The overnight attack triggered a spectacular blast outside Kherson. That city is occupied by the Russians. At the same time, Russian forces captured more towns in eastern Ukraine. The U.S. military says it has killed the leader of the Islamic State group in Syria. Central Command says that Maher al-Algal died in a drone strike today outside Jindaris near the border with Turkey. He is said to be a top five leader in ISIS, responsible for developing networks outside Iraq and Syria. On the pandemic, U.S. health officials issued new warnings today as Omicron subvariants BA4 and BA5 spread rapidly. Hospital admissions have doubled since early May. And Dr. Anthony Fauci advised against waiting for a variant-specific vaccine due this fall.
The threat to you is now. If you are not vaccinated to the fullest, namely you have not gotten your boosters according to what the recommendation are, then you're putting yourself at an increased risk that you could mitigate against by getting vaccinated.
The subvariants are highly transmissible, but officials say that the vaccines can prevent severe illness. The president of Mexico called today for transformational policies along the U.S.-Mexico border. Andres Manuel López Obrador met with President Biden at the White House. He said bold economic development efforts are needed to curb illegal border crossings. In May, U.S. immigration arrests hit record highs along the border. Meanwhile, First Lady Jill Biden apologized for a botched compliment about Latinos. It happened Monday during a speech in San Antonio. Mrs. Biden said the Latino community is, quote, as distinct as the bodegas in the Bronx, as beautiful as the blossoms of Miami, and as unique as the breakfast tacos in San Antonio. Today, the First Lady's office said she meant to convey admiration and not disrespect. The U.S. Senate confirmed Steve Dettelbach today as director of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. The vote was 48-46 to give the agency its first permanent director since 2015. Dettelbach is a former federal prosecutor. He has pledged to tackle gun violence as the nation reels from a series of high-profile attacks. Bail reform advocates in Detroit agreed today to a legal settlement aimed at reducing racial inequality. The American Civil Liberties Union and others had sued. They cited longstanding complaints over jailing mostly black defendants who can't pay court-imposed cash bail.
The cash bail system was originally intended to ensure that a person returns to court to face the charges against them. But instead, throughout Michigan and the nation, it has morphed into mass incarceration of the poor.
Under the settlement, judges have to specify why cash bail is needed and whether a defendant can afford to pay. U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland named Colette Peters today to lead the Federal Bureau of Prisons. The agency has been criticized over inadequate pandemic measures and allegations of corruption. Peters currently runs the state prison system in Oregon. On Wall Street today, stocks retreated again as oil prices and tech shares led the way lower. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 192 points to close at 30,981. The Nasdaq fell 107 points, that's 1%. The S&P 500 also slipped 1%. This year's Emmy nominees for entertainment TV are in, and the HBO drama Succession leads with 25 nominations. Squid Game is the first non-English language series nominated for Best Drama, and The White Lotus leads all comedy offerings with 20 nominations. The awards will be handed out in September. And the Library of Congress has named Ada Limon to be the 24th U.S. Poet Laureate. She has received widespread acclaim and won numerous awards, especially for the collection Bright Dead Things. She begins her one-year term on September 29th. Still to come on the news, our new video shows inaction by dozens of police officers in Uvalde, Texas, despite the shooting rampage. The president faces criticism for his trip to the Middle East. And NASA releases new photos from the Webb Space Telescope, including never-before-seen nebulas and galaxies.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
It's been 7 weeks since a gunman opened fire inside Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas, killing 19 children and two teachers. As William Brangham reports, new surveillance footage out today sheds light on what happened inside the school on that tragic day. And a warning, some viewers may find this material disturbing.
Judy, it is still an open question why it took officers such a long period of time to confront the shooter inside the school. This four-minute video compilation was released by the Austin American-Statesman. It was compiled from over 70 minutes of footage.
The video shows the shooter entering the school, going down a hallway where he then shot over 100 rounds into two classrooms. 3 minutes later, the first officers arrive, armed and in bulletproof vests. They're shot at and pull back. Within about half an hour, dozens of officers with long guns and shields take up positions in the hallway. Later, more shots are heard from down the hall. 77 minutes in, law enforcement enters the classroom and kill the gunman.
Investigative reporter Tony Plahetsky is of the Austin American-Statesman. He acquired this never-before-seen footage. Tony, great to have you back on the NewsHour. I wonder, this is such a striking document of what we've all been wondering is what had actually happened in there. What stands out the most to you from this video?
I think, first of all, just the image of a man walking so casually into an elementary school in our country carrying an AR-15. Certainly, there has been much conversation and much reporting about the law enforcement response. But I think that this video really highlights that whatever happened that day began with that man and an AR-15 walking into that school. But there are other striking moments as well, including a small child who apparently is exiting the bathroom and peeks around the corner and sees the gunman walking down the hall and then the sound of gunfire, and he runs back into the bathroom. But then again, just watching the law enforcement officers in that hallway as yet more and more assault rifles are brought to the hallway, as more protective equipment arrives, as tear gas canisters arrive, experts say that they had more than enough, many minutes before they went into that school, more than enough equipment and firepower to take on this gunman.
That delayed response has been blamed on the school district police chief. But this video does show that there were local, state, and federal agencies all amassed in that hallway. This seems to undercut some of the argument of blaming just one agency. And do we have any better sense of why it took them so long, where that chain of command fell apart?
Well, certainly, William, investigators and the head of the Texas Department of Public Safety has described this as a failure of law enforcement and not singling out one particular agency. Keep in mind, and the video certainly substantiates this, and that is there were law enforcement officers from the local community there in Uvalde, as well as state police and federal agents there as well. We know that ultimately it was a team led by the Border Patrol that breached that classroom door at 12:50. Keep in mind, the gunman entered the school at 11:33 in the morning.
Yes, this seems to sort of, again, knock down the idea that the shooter was no longer a threat. We heard shots after all the police were inside there, that this was still an active shooter and not a shooter who was barricaded and didn't need to be confronted.
Well, and not only that, William, it's also very much worth noting as part of this that there were repeated 911 calls as well from children and adults alike, asking for help, describing the extent of their injuries. And yet again, so much time elapsed before we know that they ultimately breached that classroom door, really going against what experts resoundingly say is the way law enforcement should handle these types of situations.
And we know, lastly, that parents and members of that community have wanted to see this video and to understand what happened much better. We know there was a rally in town on Sunday night where many people expressed a real sense of distrust about the police. This seems like this is only going to confound that concern.
Certainly, there have been many calls for increased transparency among the families of the victims of what happened that terrible day. And frankly, that helped drive our decision to publish and air this video as we have done today.
Tony Plahetsky of the Austin American-Statesman, again, thank you so much for your superb reporting.
Thank you.
Tonight, President Biden is departing for his first trip to the Middle East as president. It is delicate diplomacy for an administration that has pledged to put human rights first, but is also balancing Middle East realities, especially in Saudi Arabia. That is where the president will spend Friday and Saturday. Tomorrow, he will be in Jerusalem, and that's where Nick Schifrin begins our coverage.
It's a city holy to three religions, but this week they raised three colors, the red, white, and blue. They rolled out the red carpet and buffed the busts at the Israeli president's house, and they called out the cavalry ahead of President Biden's arrival. Israel and the U.S. want to focus on defense. Israel, the U.S., and regional Arab militaries are working together on air defense using Israeli technology, including the still-in-production Iron Dome lasers. They're designed to combat common enemy Iran and its own advancing missile technology. It's also an outgrowth of the Trump administration's efforts to normalize Arab-Israeli relations. What Biden will not announce, changes to Trump administration policies, including the closure of the U.S.'s Jerusalem consulate that focused on Palestinian affairs and declaring Jewish settlements on the occupied West Bank not a violation of international law.
He is coming as an extension of Trump's policies rather than as an antidote.
Hanan Ashrawi has been a Palestinian leader for decades.
He's acting on the basis that you can ignore the Palestinians, you can weaken the Palestinians, you can bash them into submission, you can give them a few handouts and symbolic gestures and they lie down and die quietly.
President Biden will announce support for a hospital network in East Jerusalem and for the two-state solution.
President Biden and his advisors talk about how they believe in the two-state solution. Do you think, you laugh, do you think that's real?
Look. There is a real disconnect between the verbal level and reality on the ground. It's not enough to say we believe in the two-state solution. Israel has systematically destroyed the two-state solution by attempting to destroy the Palestinian state. We want not these empty words, not hollow promises. We want to see action that says we are serious.
For acting Israeli Prime Minister Yair Lapid, the visit is about looking beyond the Palestinians.
From Jerusalem, President Biden will fly to Saudi Arabia. He will carry with him a message of peace and hope from us.
The Saudi visit acknowledges Middle East reality. These days, the region's pomp and circumstance is often reserved for Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. He's known as MBS, and the 36-year-old's been on a regional tour as the man who will be king. He's been trying to modernize the kingdom under his Vision 2030, giving women more rights and curbing religious extremists. But U.S. officials also believe he is the source of the kingdom's crackdown on its critics. U.S. officials told PBS NewsHour he's believed to have personally blessed the 2018 murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi inside Saudi Arabia's Istanbul consulate. The following year, candidate Biden promised punishment.
We were going to, in fact, make them pay the price and make them, in fact, the pariah that they are.
Human rights will be the center of our foreign policy.
Despite those words and warnings, the administration says now is the time to visit Saudi Arabia to discuss the truce that's currently holding in Yemen and to increase oil production.
America's values, human rights, are a strategic interest of the United States. So is energy security. So is stopping terrorism. So is seeking peace in a place like Yemen.
But that's not good enough for the kingdom's critics.
MBS and the Saudi regime is going to take this as a green light that they can commit abuses without any accountability.
Arij al-Sadnan is an American citizen whose brother Abdul Rahman is also an American. He was working as a humanitarian in Saudi Arabia when he was arrested in 2018. He's been sentenced to 20 years in prison.
He got held in a secret prison and brutally tortured. And he was denied completely any communication with us. All of that because he dared to criticize in an anonymous account the abuses and the repression that is happening in the country.
Saudi Arabia has launched reforms that MBS says are meant to, quote, bolster the principles of justice, enforce transparency, and protect human rights.
Mohammed bin Salman's defenders say that he's a modernizer, that Vision 2030 will remake the country.
I would say actions speak louder than words. It has been even becoming more abusive than before. It is imprisoning people, torturing people, disappearing people.
And al-Sadnan says she and her family have faced online death threats.
And so why are you willing to do this interview and speak out?
Staying silent to me is a lot more risky than actually speaking up. If I stay silent, and I get targeted, I'll be murdered in silence, and nobody knows about my case, nobody knows about my brother's case, but at least if they're gonna come after me and murder me, at least right now I'm known, my brother's case is known.
Despite those worries and requests by Saudi activists to President Biden he not travel to the kingdom, U.S. officials say that it is vital right now to talk to Saudi officials about furthering Saudi-Israeli cooperation and Israeli integration into the larger region. Judy.
And Nick, you've learned what concrete announcements we should expect from this trip.
Yeah, so a senior Israeli official tells me tonight that the Prime Minister of Israel and the President will sign a strategic understanding document laying out where the two countries will go in the coming years. As we reported in the story, there will be that humanitarian assistance to the Palestinians announced by President Biden. And also, independent analysts who have been briefed by U.S. officials say that Saudi Arabia will allow overflights from Israel over the territory of Saudi Arabia and direct flights for Israeli Muslims during the Hajj to Saudi Arabia. Judy.
Nick Schifrin reporting on this trip from Jerusalem. Thank you, Nick. And again, later this week, President Biden will visit Saudi Arabia, a country, as we just heard, he labeled a pariah during his campaign. Amna Nawaz picks up the conversation from there.
That's right, Judy. For more on President Biden's trip and whether it's in America's interest for him to go to Saudi Arabia, we get two views. James Jeffrey had a 35-year career in the Foreign Service and served as U.S. Ambassador to Iraq and Turkey. He is now at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. That's a think tank. Dalia Dasa-Kay is a senior fellow at the University of California, Los Angeles's Burkle Center for International Relations. She has written widely about the Middle East. Welcome to you both. Thank you for joining us tonight. Dalia Dasa-Kay, I want to begin with you. You have said President Biden's decision to visit Saudi Arabia is a mistake. It never should have been planned. Explain to me why.
Yeah, well, I think the dilemma is that the president clearly has compromised on U.S. values and actually interest in accountable partners. And the likelihood is he's not likely to get many significant strategic gains from this visit. As your piece set up, this is a leadership now in Saudi Arabia believed to be responsible for the murder of a Washington Post journalist, is continuing to repress dissidents both inside the country and abroad, including U.S. citizens, and launched a catastrophic war in Yemen. So if you're going to make Saudi Arabia the centerpiece of your foreign policy, it's, I think, fair to ask, what are we going to get in return from a U.S. perspective? It's not clear the Saudis are going to be able, even if they're willing, given the tight oil market, to significantly increase oil output to affect oil prices at the pump. Israeli normalization with the Saudis, which is shaping up to be a big centerpiece of this trip, normalization is happening even without a presidential visit, and it doesn't look like a major breakthrough, despite these modest symbolic gains, is in the offing. And finally, mm-hmm. the idea of using this visit to kind of turn regional partners away from global competitors like China and Russia is also a little bit unrealistic. These partners are quite invested in these relationships. We've seen this most recently in our regional partners' unwillingness to confront Putin and mm-hmm. join in international sanctions against Russia.
Allow me to bring in Ambassador Jeffrey here. It is a striking 180, Ambassador, from pariah to a presidential visit. Doesn't this visit help rehabilitate Saudi Arabia on the world stage?
It certainly emphasizes not just Saudi Arabia, but the importance of the whole region. Let me emphasize, he's not just going to Saudi Arabia. He's going to Israel. He'll meet with the Palestinian leadership. He'll meet with all of the Gulf states, Iraq, Jordanian, and Egyptian leaders. There's a purpose to this, as he laid out in the Washington Post. It's to help integrate the region, to preserve security, to advance stability, and most importantly, as he said, to promote U.S. interests. We're facing an existential threat from China and Russia worldwide and in the Middle East by their partner, particularly Russia's partner, Iran. He's trying to build up a buy with and through with the countries of the region to deal with these threats. They won't deal 100% with them, but they're better on our side than against us. And as far as human rights go, the biggest human rights threat in the world today is emanating from Russia and China, because their totalitarian systems have the capability of threatening all of us if we don't find a way to mobilize the globe against them. And that's what he's doing in the Middle East right now.
Ambassador, if I may, was it necessary for him to go to secure some of those things, as you're talking about, to work towards those goals, to secure some of the steps that Nick Schifrin just reported they will be announcing? I mean, these are all things that the U.S. could be working on. The presidential visit brings with it a level of prestige and credibility. Did he have to go?
Absolutely. There's no doubt in my mind, from everything I've learned since the 1970s in this region, personal relationships and underlying that friendships and trust, even with people we perhaps not like to have a drink with in the evening, is absolutely important if you want them to be predictable, if you want them to move on the margins. And Dahlia is right. It's only going to be on the margins to help us when we're in a crunch. That's what he is doing. This is an investment in a regional security architecture. It doesn't promise immediate great benefits, but it's moving us in the right direction after 20 years of being in the various wrong directions in the Middle East, I fear.
Dahlia, what about that? You know, Mohammed bin Salman is 36 years old. He is clearly in line. He's not going anywhere. Is this visit just an acknowledgement that they're resigned to that fact? This is someone they have to work with?
Yeah, absolutely. Saudi Arabia is an important country. You're going to have to work with it. The question, though, is what you raised earlier, which is why did it have to be a presidential visit, choosing Saudi Arabia as the first country in the Arab world to visit with this track record and frankly, policies that have really contradicted and undermined U.S. interests in a variety of arenas. It's a different region than it was decades ago. So I think that's really the question. Was this the best way to do it? And did we miss an opportunity? Did the president perhaps miss an opportunity to promote this positive vision that I think the ambassador is outlining here? It is important to have a regional vision. Is he missing an opportunity to promote a more positive agenda that isn't going back to kind of old standard policies of military relationships with authoritarian dictators, which are not bringing stability and peace to the region? And I'm afraid that's the direction this trip is headed.
Ambassador Jeffrey, I'll give you the last word here in about the minute and a half we have left. Dahlia mentions this human rights record as well. We know Saudi Arabia carries out mass executions. We know there's been very little accountability for the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. Can the Biden administration continue to say their foreign policy is centered on human rights after this visit?
Again, it depends on what he says to the Crown Prince when he's there and what the Crown Prince does in his country afterwards. I think that's an issue we have to wait on. But I have to underline, this is not a choice between geostrategic security on the one hand and human rights on the other. If we do not get partners and allies throughout the world to work closely with us, we're not going to stop the Russians in Ukraine. We're not going to stop the Chinese in the South China Sea or in Taiwan. And we're not going to stop the Iranians continuing to essentially ruin countries as they have Lebanon contributed to in Yemen, Syria, and potentially Iraq. That's the fear that the people of the region see. That's why they're turning to President Biden. And everyone in the region is delighted he's coming out there, minus the Iranians.
Dahlia, what about that regional note, as Ambassador Jeffrey just mentioned, and the potential normalization ahead for Israeli-Saudi relations?
Well, look, normalization is good, but I think we need to understand that without dealing with the festering Palestinian conflict, there will not ever be true peace and stability in the region, least of all for Palestinians and Israelis themselves. And in terms of the anti-Iran front, I think we also have to understand, yes, many states are looking for U.S. engagement, but are also concerned that they will be in the crosshair and be targeted by Iran with too active of an anti-Iranian stance. This is not a monolithic region. There are different viewpoints. So it's going to be a long struggle for that. So we do need to think about the balance of what we are risking here. And we have American forces in the region vulnerable to Iranian attacks and groups aligned with Iran. So this trip carries risks as well as some questions about what gains we're getting.
It's a big trip. We'll be following for sure. Ambassador Jim Jeffrey, Dahlia Dasa-Kay, thank you both for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
NASA shared new revelations today from the James Webb Telescope, the largest space observatory ever made. The incredible images capture distant galaxies, new stars and planets, and the farthest look into the birth of the cosmos ever recorded. Our science correspondent Miles O'Brien is here to break it all down. So hello, Miles. Tell us what it is about this James Webb Telescope that enables it to see farther in distance and further in time than the Hubble could.
Well, Judy, it has a much bigger mirror. It's 21 feet in diameter. The Hubble's is about 6 feet, so it can gather up a lot more light. The other thing is it looks in the infrared part of the spectrum. And because of the nature of the expansion of the universe, when you want to see the most distant things, they all live in the infrared part of the spectrum. And so it is seeing things that Hubble literally cannot. And already it's exciting.
So the first spectacular image, Miles, was released yesterday by the White House. Tell us more about that one.
Well, it's called a deep field. It's a time exposure on what seems to be just a dark piece of void. But look at this. Thousands of galaxies we've never seen before. Took them about 12 and a half hours to get this time exposure. Hubble, to do a similar shot, it took 10 days plus. So this is the deepest we've ever seen into space in the infrared, and astronomers are astounded by the detail.
The detail, and we could look at these pictures all day, but as you remind us, it's not just about the pictures.
Yeah, the scientists are interested in the data, too. Look at this exoplanet, which orbits around a star called WASP-96b. Using the spectroscopy instrument, they were able to identify water and clouds and haze. And while Webb is not designed to find exoplanets, it may help us find at least the constituent parts for life, although it's not a life finder itself.
And another thing you were telling us, Miles, is this new telescope is able to capture stars as they're being born and as they are dying. Explain what that's all about.
Yeah, it's kind of like dust to dust. Let's start with the Southern Ring Nebula. This is a dying planetary nebula, a dying star. And when you look at it, you can see ever so faintly a second star, which astronomers had not previously seen before. The infrared, in addition to looking farther, can cut through the clouds, the dust. And then on the other end of the life spectrum, if you will, let's look at the Carina Nebula. This is a nebula which is a star nursery, if you will, 7,600 light years away. And this image just, it's kind of emotional looking at it. It's so beautiful. Astronomers are just stunned by the level of detail and their ability to see things through those dusty clouds. Amber Strawn is Webb's deputy project scientist for communications.
In this view, we see some great examples, first of all, of hundreds of new stars that we've never seen before. We see examples of bubbles and cavities and jets that are being blown out by these newborn stars. We even see some galaxies sort of lurking in the background up here. We see examples of structures that, honestly, we don't even know what they are. Like, what's going on here?
That's precisely what you want to hear, Judy. When a scientist says, what's going on here, that means that instrument is on the cutting edge and there's going to be a lot of discoveries ahead.
So last thing, Miles, the fact that Hubble and James Webb can now target the same thing, how does that advance science?
Well, anytime you have multiple platforms looking at the same objects, scientists love that because they can verify their data. And what's interesting about some of these Webb images is they're not of new locations. We've known about some of these for quite some time. Look at Stefan's Quintet, 290 million light years away. You might recognize it. It is the galaxy which is featured in the movie, It's a Wonderful Life, when the angel is talking to God. But that's a side thought there. But these are never before seen details of five galaxies that interact with each other, this cosmic dance actually between four of them. And when you look at that, it's not only beautiful, but you really get a sense of motion and how dynamic it is. They are pulling and tugging and bumping into each other, leaving tails of gas and dust and stars. You know, the galaxies, the universe is can be a dangerous place, Judy. And sometimes we look at it, it seems so static and quiet. But there you get a sense of the real energy involved.
Just like a miracle on top of a miracle. You want to hear classical music when you look at these
with the quintet,
photographs. Miles O'Brien, what a great job you have. Thank you.
You're welcome, Judy.
And we are but a tiny speck. And tomorrow night here on PBS, Nova has a behind-the-scenes look at the daunting challenges scientists had to overcome to create the Webb telescope. You can watch Ultimate Space Telescope on your local station beginning at 9 p.m. Eastern. Check your local listings. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening for all of us at the PBS NewsHour. Thank you. Please stay safe, look at those pictures, and we'll see you soon.